So good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me in the back, David? Good. Thank you all for coming, and welcome to the opening lecture for Cornell University Library's Spring Exhibition, Animal Legends from the Trojan Horse to Godzilla. I'm Ann Kenny. I'm the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian. And before I turn to introducing our speaker, two things. First, if you have cell phones, could you please turn them off? And second, I want to take a couple of minutes to tell you a story about Jumbo the elephant, whom Barnum and Bailey billed as the biggest elephant in the world in the late 19th century. Captured in Africa in 1865, Jumbo spent many years thrilling crowds at the London Zoo until P.T. Barnum bought him for America. He spent more than a week traveling the ocean in a giant crate, arriving in New York on April 9th, 1882, to great fanfare. Barnum's publicity machine drummed up massive public interest. In his memoirs, Barnum wrote that within 2 weeks of Jumbo's first appearance, ticket returns more than made up for the $30,000 it cost him to purchase and transport Jumbo. Fascination with the 6.5-ton, 13-foot-tall pachyderm gripped America, just as it had previously swept thousands in England, including Queen Victoria and the young Winston Churchill. Sadly, Jumbo met a tragic end just 3 years after his New York debut, when he was hit by a train in Canada. Barnum gave the stuffed hide to Tufts University, which adopted Jumbo as its mascot. His skeleton was donated to the American Museum of Natural History in New York, where it is still displayed today. And Cornell, too, got its part of Jumbo. One of the items on display in the exhibit is a large unmarked glass cylinder. For many years, that jar held Jumbo's massive heart. Bert Green Wilder, a Cornell professor of anatomy, neurology, and zoology, urged the university to purchase it as a study specimen, and Cornell bought the heart for $40, which translates close to $1,000 today. In 1897, the Cornell Daily Sun remarked on the heart's immense size, but also its poor state of repair. And sometime during the next 50 years, the heart disappeared entirely. The specimen was initially kept in the university's museum in McGraw Hall and later moved to Stimson. But Cornell professor Howard Evans found the empty jar there in the 1940s, with only a label identifying it as the former home of Jumbo's heart. I tell you this story not just to pique your curiosity about the exhibit, although I hope it will do that too, but to use it as an illustration. Books, manuscripts, archival material, and other historical artifacts all require interpreters and storytellers so that history comes alive through them. Without knowing the story of Jumbo's heart, that big glass jar would be nothing more than, well, a big glass jar. With the story, however, it becomes a meaningful piece of a larger puzzle that reveals something fascinating about the way humans interact with animals. It invites reflection on the process of our society's cultural selection and inspires debate about why and how certain animals become legends, and how and why humans elevate special species or individual animals into roles of hero, deity, or icon of fashion. Jumbo's story is just one of many featured in the exhibit opening today, stories that illuminate the persistence of animal legends and fables through time and place and culture, and our impulse to celebrate certain animal personalities. The exhibit draws upon artifacts in the library's rare collections and other collections on campus that help us illustrate the past and present of human-animal relations, which increasingly are studied from a multitude of cross-disciplinary perspectives in both academic and popular contexts. I hope you will join me for the reception and the opening of the exhibit in Kroc Library immediately following this lecture to see some of the examples on display, including dragons carved into a book of jade made in honor of the first emperor of unified China, E.B. White's original manuscripts and drawings for Charlotte's Web, and some of the earliest appearances of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. I want to thank the curator of this wonderful exhibit, Laurent Ferry, and Catherine Reagan, Ernest L. Stern Curator of Rare Books and Manuscripts, for her leadership of our exhibits program. Laurent and Catherine were helped by exhibits coordinator Aisha Prather, along with almost two dozen other people, from curators in the library's Asia collections who contributed additional writing and selections, including Godzilla, to skilled conservators, to language experts who helped translate materials. And our donors, Stephen E. and Evelyn Edwards Millman, are an integral part of that team as well. This is the second opening and exhibition funded through the Millman family's generous endowment, and we're so very grateful for their faith in us and their commitment to telling the story the library's collections have to offer. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce a prominent storyteller, Dr. Laura Brown, whose talk, Love, Paradise, and the Rise of the Animal in English Literature, provides the first lecture in conjunction with the Animal Legends exhibit. Dr. D.F. Anzac, Professor of Equine Medicine in the College of Veterinary Medicine, will deliver our second lecture in this space on June 9th, entitled Hybrids and Chimeras, Real and Imagined, Crossing Forbidden Boundaries in the Animal Kingdom. Laura Brown came to Cornell in 1981 and holds the John Wendell Anderson Chair in the Department of English. And in 2009, she was appointed Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education. She is a scholar and critic of English 18th century and has written six books and numerous articles on literary figures such as Jonathan Swift, Alexander Pope, John Dryden, Henry Fielding, Samuel Richardson, and Daniel Defoe. Now, some unexpected characters join that auspicious list. In her new book, Homeless Dogs and Melancholy Apes, Humans and Other Animals in the Modern Literary Imagination, Laura examines how literary works in 18th century England used animals to bring abstract philosophical and metaphysical questions into the realm of everyday experience. So please join me in welcoming Vice Provost Laura Brown.
Thanks very much for that great introduction. It's really lovely to be able to speak to, I feel like I'm getting feedback. Can you hear me okay? Okay. It's great to be able to speak to an audience of friends and colleagues. I can't decide whether that makes this a more friendly or a more critical audience. Sometimes it varies. But I also want to thank Anne and Catherine and Laurent for inviting me to be a part of this exhibit. And I urge you to go and see the exhibit. It's a fascinating and really varied display of materials on animals. I won't pursue my temptation to tell stories about elephants that I've encountered in my own life, and also hippopotami. There was a wandering hippopotamus while I was a graduate student in Berkeley that they couldn't find in the waters of the bay. I'll do that later. But let me start talking about Love and Paradise. Today we see animals all around us in literary culture. A trip to Barnes & Noble or to Amazon.com, I guess unfortunately no longer to Borders, reveals arrays of animal-centered works, including prominent stories of dogs, cats, apes, spiders, pigs, and horses, not to mention owls, hawks, parrots, whales, and mules. And I just noticed a couple of lions recently and cheetahs, and I discovered a story about a wayward moose. So I'll stop there, but I could go on for the whole rest of this paper enumerating the stories of animals that we can read about in our bookstores. animal stories focusing on dogs are so commonplace that we can basically distinguish multiple canine subgenres. There are travels with dogs, memoirs of dogs, autobiographies of dogs, rescue dogs. There are detective dogs. We can find stories about sheep trial dogs. Christmases with dogs were very prominent in December. And there are supernatural dogs and thriller stories with dog protagonists as well. For us, these opportunities to bring animals into our immediate imaginative experience seem pretty normal and straightforward. But I want to demonstrate today that this widespread literary representation of animal kind is rather new in literary history. It has its roots in major historical changes in the human-animal relationship, and it has a significant impact on our understanding of convention and innovation in literature itself. Non-human animals give humans unusual opportunities to experiment with the imagination. And in the 18th century, we can isolate some of those key experiments and we can analyze their effects. In earlier periods, literary animals served as emblems. They were symbolic or metaphorical figures that represented specific human values, virtues, and concepts. For instance, lust, loyalty, cunning. This so-called emblematic worldview was replaced in the 18th century by empirical thinking and by an analytical approach to the natural world, an approach that fundamentally changed the ways in which animals were represented. In close connection with these conceptual shifts, the lived relationship between humans and animals also saw a fundamental change, which we can trace to two major historical events that occurred almost simultaneously: the discovery of the hominoid ape and the invention of widespread pet keeping. And I'm using discovery and invention deliberately, as you'll see. In each of these arenas, animals entered the space and consciousness of human beings in a distinctively new way, directly inspiring a set of fundamental questions about and challenges to conventional beliefs about the nature, status, and definition of the human. The discovery of the hominoid ape in Western Europe was the result of the expansion of travel, trade, and exploration from this area to the rest of the world in the 16th and 17th century. Whereas previously information about the great apes was absorbed into philological debates or mythological argumentation, in this period the proximity between apes and humans was suddenly captured the attention of scientists and philosophers as if they were newly discovered beings. As European thinkers became engaged with discussions of the human-like anatomy, sensibility, intelligence, and behaviors of the great apes, an explosion of popular and scientific speculation arose around human identity and genealogy, and about the relationship between humans and non-human animals. The new idea of the proximity of human and animal was felt widely and variously in the intellectual movements of the 18th century. Influential social thinking about progress and improvement drew concrete credibility from the suggestion that animals might be able to better themselves, that apes, for instance, might be able to be taught to speak. The new humanitarian movements of the late 18th century derived their felt credibility from the claim that, for example, in regard to the experience of suffering, that humans and animals were indistinguishable. And a new understanding of the continuity in the so-called chain of being, which intimately connected humans with the animals below the human in the chain, anticipated 19th century theories of biological evolutionism or the transformation of species. Echoing and continuing the extraordinary impact on modern thought and culture of the discovery of the great apes in the 18th century is the humbler and more immediate exposure to the same intimacy of human and animal, the invention of modern pet keeping. Humans have lived in close proximity with animals throughout human history, of course, but the particular material practices and modes of interaction characteristic of the human relationship with pets is a highly distinctive and historically specific phenomenon compared to the lived human-animal intimacies of earlier periods. Pets are, and pet keeping is founded on domestic cohabitation, on the construction of a relationship of companionship, on the individuation of the animal companion who is always called by a specific name, and upon a special injunction that separates the pet from all other animals, which is anyone. A pet is never a meal, right. A pet is never a potential meal. Historically, the rise of pet keeping was a sudden event, and in this regard, we can call it a cultural invention. In the early 18th century, pet keeping grew exponentially, reaching a point of what has been described as a cultural obsession. The affective bonding represented by pet keeping coincides with the growth of commercial bourgeois society, so the companion animal seems to have been in part an antidote to the alienation and commodification of modern urban life. And much like the discovery of the great apes, pet keeping led to the development of new ideas about animal intelligence, new debates about animal souls, new ideas about the nature of kinship and affiliation, new assertions about animal character, the idea of canine loyalty, for instance, and new practices of breeding, training, dressing or grooming, and maintenance of animals. Here, let me stop briefly and illustrate with a couple of visual images those claims about the invention of pet keeping. I should point out that we did pass out, and I think you may have in your hands, a list of the works that I'm displaying. These are to give you some idea of the relevance of pet keeping to 18th century portraiture in particular, which is a dominant form in the visual arena in this period. And pets were everywhere in the portraiture and visual arts. This is Hogarth's self-portrait with his pug, Trump. This was designed by Hogarth to serve as the frontispiece to his Complete Prints. Hogarth's portraits of his pugs are famous for studying the animal face as closely as the human face, and Hogarth made his two pugs, Pug and Trump, famous in London during this period, not just as artistic signatures, they were an embodiment of Hogarth's particular character, but as individuated personalities. I've also included an animal portrait by Gainsborough. These are all of real-life, individual, personally known animals, not generic animals. And this is Gainsborough's Tristram and Fox, two dogs that Gainsborough knew. And another portrait, another Hogarth portrait, his of Mary Edwards, showing how common it was in this period to depict women with their dogs. Together, the discovery of the great apes and the invention of pet keeping created different ways of thinking about the nature of the human. Imaginative writing about animals absorbed these ideas and expressed them as surprising, unusual, or unexpected relationships or aspirations. I'm going to argue that if we look closely at the representation of animals in this period, we can discover new genres, new types of literary production in which the inclusion of animals creates a special opportunity for innovation. The literature of this period shows us how writers, inspired directly or indirectly by these historical innovations, used animals to rethink a range of conventions, among them love and paradise. So let's start with love and with the first modern literary genre that develops as a result of the historical changes that I've just described, which I'll call the lapdog poem. In the early 18th century, lapdog poetry was a widespread popular literary form. In fact, this genre is the first visible literary manifestation of the new connection that I've been describing between human and non-human animals. Lapdog poetry includes epitaphs for lapdogs, satires on lapdogs, and praise poems for lapdogs. We know that they belong to the same new genre because they tend to share a specific group of images, which I will shortly describe, and which are all focused on the female figure, the lady and her lapdog. And you'll shortly see why I've chosen this Courbet image as for this part, to illustrate this part of the talk. This is Gustave Courbet's Nude with Dog. In fact, this image of the woman and the animal is the inaugural event for the rise of the animal in the modern literary imagination. Women introduce us to animals as newly intimate companions with all of the complexities and discomforts that follow upon that introduction. We can see the effects of the lapdog poem on later representations of animals in the 19th century novel, and more important for us in the context of the role of the animal in generating literary innovations, these images inspire a very unusual depiction of love. Lapdog poems portray a special interspecies connection, very new in popular literature, which follows a typical scenario. These poems turn into investigations of a surprising cross-species affinity, usually expressed as a sexual connection, and they focus especially on the woman's bed, the breast, the nap, the lap, sometimes the adoring sexual gaze, and especially the woman's kiss, or as an extension of the kiss, a certain amount of licking. These images have a very long life, and they influence depictions of love and even of human intimacy well beyond the rise of the animal in this early literature. So let's start with the female bed and extract the key words that create the framework for these poems' innovation. And these are rhyme words, very common rhyme connections in the lapdog poetry. Nap rhymes with lap. Bliss and anybody? Kiss. Lies and thighs. Or clung and tongue. Got it. They spring to mind when you get the first word out. All common rhymes in the lapdog poetry. As we learn in the epitaph, to a lady on the death of her lapdog and squirrel in one day, little Dory had the charmingest creature in the world for his bedfellow. We hear quite a bit about bedfellows in these poems, although the squirrels are never bedfellows. It's only the lapdogs. We hear quite a bit about bedfellows in these poems and a similar amount about laps. Jonathan Smedley in his verses on the death of a lapdog provides a typical sample. To him, her softest things she'd say. Oft on her downy breast he lay, and oft he took a gentle nap upon her sleep-enticing lap. A couplet from Edward Stevens' poem on the death of Delia's lapdog illustrates another of these verbal pairs. Pompey, companion dear to miss, full oft was honored with a kiss, as does Henry Carey's complaint to the lady in the rival lapdog. I have this slide up now if you can read it. Corinna, pray tell me, when thus you repel me, when humbly I sue for a kiss, why Donny at pleasure may kiss without measure and surfeit himself with the bliss. These modern canine adaptations of the love lyric also include the image of the sexual gaze, which accompanies the kiss and extends that physical link between the lady and the lapdog into the incorporeal realm. This is a revision of that motif of the gaze from Petrarchan love poetry. So, for example, Isaac Thompson's The Lapdog adds an evocation of the animal's eyes. I have that on the screen now. This is at the top of the right-hand column. Securely on her lap it lies, or freely gazes on her eyes. To touch her breast may share the bliss, and unreproved may snatch a kiss. The bliss mentioned here introduces this quite sexually explicit theme, which some poems explore more directly. For instance, an epitaph upon my Lady M's lapdog presents the bedfellow idea in warmer language. Beneath this stone, woeful case, poor little Doxy lies, who once possessed a warmer place between his lady's thighs. Lapdog poetry is presented in the voice of a male onlooker, and he often expresses a feeling of envy for the non-human being whom, as we have seen, he observes to be positioned in the lady's breast, at the lady's breast or between the lady's thighs. For instance, On a Lapdog by Thomas Brown addresses the dog with this exclamation. The dog is named Nice. Nice, pretty nice. Ah, couldst thou know how thou dost my envy raise? And he goes on to describe how furious he is with the dog, because the dog lies in that lap that he wants to lie in. And he asks whether the dog will consider an exchange of place and station so that the dog's privilege will be his. Here, the speaker is actually wishing he were a dog, and he's wishing the dog were in his place, in a way that highlights an inversion of the hierarchy that normally ranks human above animal kind. Thompson's The Lap Dog goes further by describing a magic substitution, and this is in the middle of the page that you have before you. Give me a spell, a potent charm, to turn myself to Minnie's form. In sportful dance and wanton play, on Sylvia's lap I'd spend the day. And John Hewitt's poem, Upon Celia's Having a Little Dog in Her Lap, expresses a clear preference to be a four-footed being rather than a man. He says, 'Tis four-footed Chloe your smiles can engage, whilst a shape that is human must bear with your rage. Since thus my addresses by Celia is refused, pray, who would be man when a dog's so well used?" This painting by Rowlandson, The Gardener's Offering, gives you an idea of the notion of the competition between the beau and the dog, which the dog invariably won in these poems. The beau is never preferred to the canine companion. So I think you may be beginning to see how potentially disturbing these poems become, despite their comic tone, in pushing this image of interspecies intimacy beyond conventional boundaries that would normally place the animal and the human on different levels of the scale of being, and also in suggesting a potential transposition from one species to another. Who would be man is a really alarming question in the broader scheme of the day, at a time when some philosophers, anatomists, linguists, and biologists were becoming persuaded that one really couldn't tell whether orangutans really were a race of humans, whether humans really were animals. An extended poem on this topic entitled The Rival Lapdog and the Tail provides a good example of the ways in which lapdog poetry overturns conventional representations of human intimacy. This work tells the story of a King Charles Spaniel of ancient stock whose monstrous act is to supplant my lord in his lady's bed. We learn that he was courtly bred, that court company he kept, with lords he dined, with ladies slept. He takes saucy freedoms with his lady's belongings and her clothes, but beyond that, he is seen to touse her with his paw, and the lady, in turn, was proud to have her dear dog rude with her as e'er he could. The poem ends with a sustained interspecies love scene that I'll read to you. I thought of leaving this out, but I might as well. Breast to breast incorporate almost, he lay like dog in state. Fair lady, all in raptures to be so caressed by such a beau. She hugged and kissed and cried and clung, and he returned it all with his tongue. Put lady fair quite out of breath and bust her even almost to death. Sir Licklips was so tired too, he fell asleep while one tells two. Here we can find the full repertory of the images typical of lapdog poetry, the bed, the breast, the caress, combined with those raptures, kissing, crying, and ending with the tongue part and the licking. The most famous example of a lapdog poem in the literature of the 18th century is Alexander Pope's poem, The Rape of the Lock. This poem opens with the protagonist, Belinda, in bed with her lapdog, the locus classicus of, as we've seen, of the lapdog poem. The first lines describe the sun peeping through the curtains upon the lapdog and the lady. The lapdog, the earlier riser, gives himself a rousing shake, but Belinda, still her downy pillow pressed. So Belinda sleeps for another 100 lines until Shock, who thought she slept too long, leapt up and waked his mistress with his tongue. It's an innocent enough line if you limit it to the context of Pope's poem, but in relationship to the larger phenomenon of lapdog poetry, you can see Pope utilizing these typical images that we've seen in the other poems. his audience would have understood this passage in a very different way than you did when you first read Pope's Rape of the Lock. The effect here and throughout the lapdog poetry is to bring two species into a surprising proximity in a way that unbalances our assumptions about difference and kinship, hierarchy and equality, human and animal, and that creates possibilities for new affinities, possibilities that carry forward into future imaginative engagements between women and animal kind. For these lapdog poems, the reversals of place and partner call up larger questions generated by the portrayal of interspecies connection elsewhere in the literature and thought of the period, questions about the absolute antithesis of beings, about the definition of the human by the animal, about the substitutability of the one for the other, or even about the potential for these reversals to lead to new kinds of relationships of affinity, new kinds of love. Quite a bit after the lapdog poetry loses its hold on the imagination of readers, which happened after about 50 years, we can find clear echoes of the typical imagery and effects that we've seen at this early point in the rise of the animal in the literary imagination. I'll end this section on love then by citing one very canonical example from beyond the 18th century where these same images from the lapdog poetry are deployed, Charles Dickens. There, it turns out, are many dogs in Dickens' novels if you look closely. Dickens' dogs fit into the paradigm of the lapdog tradition with one exception. Dickens liked large dogs. Dombey and Son, for instance, contains a very large, prominent dog, Diogenes, who, except for his size, could be one of the subjects of the earlier poetic tradition that we've been looking at. The novel's protagonist, Florence Dombey, has no human family member to love her, and so she's given Diogenes, her brother's dog, upon his death. And her intimacy with the dog is a direct substitute for and alternative to the traditional love of a parent for a child. In his description of Diogenes, Dickens depends upon the same key images that we have seen in the lapdog poetry, including a bedside encounter, an intimate embrace, a licking scene, a description of a special kind of love, and a transposition of the boundaries of kinship and species. Dickens describes their intimacy in this way. Diogenes was dearer to Florence than the most valuable and beautiful of his kind. "Come then, Di, dear Di, let us love each other," said Florence, fondling his shaggy head. And Di, the rough and gruff, as if his hairy hide were pervious to the tear that dropped upon it, and his dog's heart melted as it fell, put his nose up to her face and swore fidelity. He rose up on his hind legs with his awkward paws on her shoulders, licked her hands and face, and nestled his great head against her heart. He even lies down next to her while she's asleep in her bed. When poor Florence was at last asleep, he scratched open her bedroom door, rolled up his bed into a pillow, lay down with his head towards her, and looking lazily at her, upside down, out of the tops of his eyes, he himself fell asleep. This bedside gaze, added to the image of the dog's head against her heart or breast, the tear, the strange canine human embrace with his awkward paws, and the licking images, all reproduce the language that we found in the lapdog poetry without the rhymes. Diogenes is a latter-day Dickensian lapdog. In Dickens' novel, these images join the female figure and the animal and allude to that special intimacy that we've seen before, even though Dickens would not have gone so far as to recreate the sexual allusions of the lapdog poems. Just as the lapdog replaces the conventional intimacy with the husband or suitor in the lapdog poetry, this canine-female connection with the conventional familiar relationship that Florence lacks replaces the kinship relationship between humans with a new one between human and animal. Florence is neglected by her alienated father, but the love that explicitly replaces his and that serves as a direct alternative to human affinity and human kinship is that of an animal. The lapdog poetry then has a powerful literary resonance beyond its own time. It's one of the first occasions in which the new experience of human-animal proximity is expressed in literary form, and it uses that proximity to describe a connection that undercuts traditional notions of affinity and to suggest a transposition that calls conventions of species difference into question. It provides a way of seeing difference between beings rather than similarities between beings as a basis for love. Meanwhile, the other half of my story, which I promised would be about paradise, the other half of my story about the unconventional uses of animals in the literary imagination leads to a different means of overturning tradition. Alongside the lapdog poetry, but a few decades later, another appeal to the new understanding of animal kind arises in the invention of a different new genre, the dog novel. Stories with dog protagonists are very common today, but the first of these in English, The History of Pompey the Little by Francis Coventry, was published in the mid-18th century and reprinted frequently over the next 20 years. In other words, it was a bestseller. This narrative follows the life of a lapdog who moves from hand to hand, from mistress to master, through a series of adventures that involve fashionable ladies, bourgeois families, a beggar, a highwayman, a penniless poet, a scholar, and finally a fashionable lady again at the end of his life. The dog novel is influenced by lapdog poetry, and we can see this influence in the depiction of little Pompey's interaction with his fashionable mistresses who treat him as, quote, a great favorite, and caress him with the fondest tenderness and permit him to sleep every night in a chair by their bedside and embrace him with an ardor which the happiest lover might have envied. But Pompey the Little tells a much longer story and adds a different kind of innovation to the developing repertory of the realist novel. Diverging from the main contemporary tradition of prose fiction, which was based on the representation of everyday reality, of things that could happen in the world around us, Pompey the Little uses the little dog's intimacy with his mistress to explore a realm outside of everyday reality, a paradise for dogs. Lady Tempest describes this unusual option during a debate about the hierarchy of, during a debate about the immortality of the soul, which she resolves through a demonstration of her intimacy with her pet dog, Pompey. "My dear little creature," said Lady Tempest, catching him up in her arms, "will you go to heaven along with me? I shall be vastly glad of your company, Pompey, if you will." This conversation about the lapdog's afterlife reflects a new theological and philosophical debate that arose along with the historical changes in human-animal proximity that I described at the outset. Central to this debate is the question about whether animals have souls. Whereas the dominant previous thinking absolutely distinguished animals or beasts from humans in various ways, new ideas about the anatomical, behavioral, or intellectual similarities between humans and animals, new concepts of humanitarianism, new systems of biological classification that put humans and animals into a continuum, all worked to push the theological discussions about animal souls in a new direction. And here's a quote from an early 18th century commentator on this topic, Lord Bolingbroke. "Absurd and impertinent vanity. We pronounce our fellow animals to be automates, or we allow them instinct, or we bestow graciously upon them, at the utmost stretch of liberality, an irrational soul, something we know not what, but something that can claim no kindred to the human mind. We scorn to admit them into the same class of intelligence with ourselves, though it be obvious that the first inlets and the first elements of their knowledge and of ours are the same." And another widely read writer on animal souls, John Hildrop, argues in his Free Thoughts Upon the Brute Creation that since animals existed in the Garden of Eden, quote, "there seems to be a strange presumption that in the intention of their creator in their original frame," there seems to be a strong presumption that in the invention of their creator in their original frame and their relation to the universal system, they were to be partakers of that blessing and immortality, which was the privilege of the whole creation. Speculation about animals' immortality even included the notion that their resurrected souls might be, quote, transmitted to some peculiar habitations, perhaps in Saturn, Mars, or Jupiter. We'll see animals on the moon in a minute, closely related to this idea. Pompey the Little gives us a literary example of the influence of this debate on the contemporary imagination, and it creates a precedent that we can see in the tendency of subsequent dog fiction to describe an afterlife for dogs or a dog paradise from that time to the present day. In the 19th century, dog narratives become a popular subgenre. This is the period of the sudden growth of animal biography and especially dog autobiography, and the idea of the potential union of dog and human in a different realm of existence is a very common theme. Of the core group of early dog novels, the first is the anonymous Biography of a Spaniel, which is published with a frontispiece, a copperplate engraving by James Hopwood, illustrating the Elysium of dogs that's described in the opening story. And here you see Hopwood's frontispiece to the Biography of a Spaniel. I'll come back to that, but here is the opening page of the story, which describes the frontispiece image. In the midst of one of the large seas that our astronomers have lately discovered in the moon lies a distant island. For ages innumerable, perhaps from the beginning of time, this has been the appointed Elysium of dogs, those constant and faithful companions of man. The Biography of a Spaniel gives us a good example of the way in which imaginative literature represented the new idea of a trans-species union in a prospective afterlife. At the end of the novel, the dog narrator describes his own death at the hands of some city officials. Here you can see the last pages of the Biography of a Spaniel. It may be hard. Well, maybe you can read it. A few minutes after, I saw two men approach us with guns in their hands, who by their dress I supposed to be ministers of justice. They were so, and employed by the town mayor whose son I had bit to punish my crime. I had time enough to escape, but instead of doing so, I crept closer to my master, who, when he was told the danger I was in, bent over me, thinking by so doing he should be able to protect me. But his effort was in vain. For the mercenary slaves fired, and the same ball that passed through my head penetrated his heart. "Bury us together," was the last sound I heard with my mortal faculties, and likewise the first my aerial substance comprehended. Our shades met. We tried to embrace, but an invisible power tore us asunder. Yet as the spirit of my friend ascended, it called to me and said, "We shall meet again." Now we go back to the dogs who are listening to the story he's telling. "Yes, so you will," re-echoed the united voices of the whole society of the Elysium of Dogs, who with silent admiration had listened to the stranger's relation. By posing the fundamental question of whether dogs can cross the species boundary to join their masters in a trans-species paradise, the dog narrative takes a fundamentally different path from the main line of realist fiction in the 19th century. Dog narratives in this period are open to the representation of a transcendent realm, unlike many other novels, and they bring that realm to consciousness in dreams or in the direct evocation of this liberated world beyond the here and now. Dreams are another way of depicting this transcendent world. And in the Biography of a Spaniel, we see several significant dreams in which the dog finds a spiritual union with a beloved human. For example, the canine protagonist recollects a favorite mistress in a dream. He says, "Often in my dreams did I fancy myself near the dear child, attempting to lick her hand, but was always prevented by her withdrawing herself and casting a sorrowful but affectionate look at me." In another example from the same era, Edward Augustus Kendall's Keeper's Travels in Search of His Master, Many of these dog books are about dogs losing their masters and finding their way to them, which has got to sound familiar to us today. The dog protagonist, near death, dreams of a reunion with his master. He fancied that this friend of his life was endeavoring to rescue him from his misery. He thought that his warm hand was on his neck. He thought that he dug away the perishing snow. The idea became still less distinct. He even thought himself relieved from his misery. He fancied himself in the arms of his master. He was happy. And in another anonymous work, The Dog of Knowledge, or Memoirs of Bob the Spotted Terrier, supposed to be written by himself, here is The Dog of Knowledge frontispiece. This transcendental reunion is put into lyric form. At the end of his story, the dog's voice slips from the first to the third person to narrate his own death. So he says, having now no farther services to perform than the reciprocal interchanges of duty and love, the reader can know little more of Bob than that he lived to such an age, and that when he was no more, the tear of affection bedewed his verdant grave. Then the dog narrator continues after his own death to take a respectful and final leave of the reader by quoting a poem by Samuel Jackson Pratt, a popular writer on humanitarian topics. Bob's canine voice, thus, uses human discourse to recite from beyond the grave a lyric rendition of the transcendent realm in which true sensibility, canine and human, resides. And here's the poem from The Dog of Knowledge. I'll just read a central part. But wouldst thou see an instance yet more dear, a touch more rare, thy dog may still afford the example high. Go read it on the bier, if chance some canine friend survives his lord. A while survives his latest dues to pay, beyond the grave his gratitude to prove, moan out his life in slow but sure decay, martyr sublime of friendship and of love. The exhibit has a great image of Greyfriars Bobby, who was a famous exemplary dog who lay on his master's grave and mourned him for 15 years, for a very, very long and impossibly long time. The proof of canine gratitude is also a proof of a realm beyond the present one, a realm in which the dog can indisputably lay claim to human virtue. The imaginary dog creates a unique cultural opportunity to consider an alternative to the structures and limits of the present day. In some cases, this alternative emerges as an actual representation of a metaphysical realm, a canine paradise. In others, it remains an open-ended speculation, a fantasy whose final form is not yet realized. Toward the middle of the 19th century, Margaret Scott Gatty, in Worlds Not Realized, a didactic animal advocacy novel, has her main character describe for his children the transcendent paradise for dogs from the biography of a spaniel. So the speaker is describing this scene of the dogs on the moon. The charm of that novel was that at the beginning there was a picture of a scene in the moon, a sort of paradise to which dogs were supposed to go when they died. It was the custom in that happy place for each dog upon his arrival to relate his adventures upon earth. And the picture represented a circle of dogs sitting as you are sitting now, in front of a spaniel, the hero of the tale, who was talking to them, as I'm talking to you now, and telling them the history of his life. Over this picture, I used to pore with the deepest interest, trying, by looking into it, to discover what sort of a place the moon paradise was, and wondering by what means the poor dog, who, according to the book, had just been shot dead in the street, could have gotten there. You must not suppose that I was left in such ignorance as seriously to believe that such a place as a moon paradise existed. People told me it did not, and I submitted. But I used to try and forget that it was all nonsense. Whenever I took up my book again, and I sometimes pleased myself by thinking that, as nobody knew what was in the moon, there was just a loophole of possibility that the dog paradise might be there after all. This reader, like many others, might be brought to submit to the norms that separate humans from animals, but the dog narrative continues to work against those norms, returning its reader repeatedly to that loophole of possibility of a realm where the boundaries and constraints of this world are thrown off. Now I want to show that this speculation about paradise, this loophole that was created by the rise of the animal in the literary imagination, is still relevant today by turning briefly to a recent novel by Paul Auster, Timbuktu, which was published in 2002. Timbuktu opens the same loophole in a way that speaks back to the tradition of the dog narrative and especially to its evocation of this paradise for dogs. It also helps us appreciate the sustained impact of these formative early literary experiments that mark the rise of the animal in the modern literary imagination. Timbuktu, like Pompey the Little, follows a dog protagonist, Mr. Bones, from one master to another. Mr. Bones' first master, Willie Christmas, teaches the dog that, this is the dog's interpretation of what his master has told him. So this is the dog speaking. Once your soul had been separated from your body was buried in the ground and your soul lit out for the next world. There was no doubt in the dog's mind that the next world was a real place. It was called Timbuktu. At one point, Willie described it as an oasis of spirits. At another point, he says, where the map of this world ends, that's where the map of Timbuktu begins. Willie Christmas and Mr. Bones had been wandering the streets of Baltimore without a map on a fruitless pilgrimage as Willie moves toward his own imminent death. And Willie does die in a scene close to the one I just read to you from the biography of a spaniel. In that early novel, remember, two men with guns in their hands, town policemen, come to keep order in the streets and kill the dog protagonist. And in Timbuktu also, a police car pulled up and two large men in uniforms climbed out, carrying the instruments of the law around their waists, revolvers and handcuffs, billy clubs and holsters, flashlights and bullets. They don't shoot Willie, but they do preside over his death. Meanwhile, though, Mr. Bones does not die in the streets with Willie, but lives on to survive further adventures. He is shot at. He is starved and frozen in the snow like Keeper. He is rescued briefly and lives a suburban life with the Joneses. But he ultimately comes back to the promise of a paradise for dogs and to his original master, Willie Christmas. At the end of the novel, Mr. Bones has two vivid dreams in which he approaches a reunion with Willie and finds this whole prospect of Timbuktu totally confirmed in his mind. He describes these dreams as dreams of impossible and beautiful things, of a world of strangeness and beauty beyond the boundaries of hard fact. They're dreams in which the dog protagonist suddenly found himself able to speak and converses with his master as clearly and smoothly as any two-leg yapping in his mother tongue. The fact that the dog can speak to his master proves to Mr. Bones that these dreams have taken him to join Willie in Timbuktu, since he knows that in the paradise for dogs, man's best friend would stay by the side of man after said man and said best friend had both kicked the bucket. More than that, in Timbuktu, dogs would be able to speak man's language and converse with him as an equal. These dreams are a prelude to something far more important, Timbuktu itself. And in the final scene of the novel, Mr. Bones runs onto the highway to play the, quote, venerable, time-honored sport of dodge the car, expecting that, as he says, with any luck, he would be with Willie before the day was out. His last thought as he launches himself toward the paradise for dogs is that all he had to do was step into the road and he would be in Timbuktu. He would be in the land where dogs talked as equals with men. This leap of imagination beyond the boundary of species is one of the special attributes of the rise of the animal in the literary imagination. Literary works do not always have ready to hand the language, themes, images, or narrative forms that can carry readers beyond conventions or beyond the structures of thought that largely shape our fantasies. We track those conventional structures and literary traditions because they show us how literature builds modes of expression cumulatively, how systems, precedents, intertextual repetitions, and generic expectations enable us to represent experiences so they are predictable and comprehensible. That is the largest task of the literary text. But we also need to know how and when and by what means new or disruptive or disturbing or impossible and beautiful effects enter the realm of representation. How do we get to a different place from where we were before in the world of the imagination? How do established and comprehensible ways of feeling and knowing within that world come to be changed? I'm suggesting here that animals have been a distinctive avenue to innovation, and that we have yet fully to understand why that's the case, how it operates within individual literary works, or more broadly in literary history, and ultimately where that avenue leads. That loophole of possibility that appeared with the rise of the animal in the literary imagination is still pretty wide open. Thanks a lot. I think I'll keep the paradise up there. I'll be very glad to answer questions or hear observations about dog paradises that I haven't yet documented.
Mm-hmm. Or at least reconceptualization of canonical work. So mm-hmm. Brave and the Bold stops looking like a mock epic. It starts to look like, at least in the opening, a lapdog poem, and mm-hmm. kind of a weird, not typical lapdog poem.
Right.
And then the dog narrative is different than a realist novel.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, this is kind of the question of your conclusion, I guess. But I'm just wondering if you have any speculation about
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was the question I was raising. The question is, am I claiming that if we look closely at animals, we'll see new genres that we hadn't noticed before, and that those genres will tell us something different about the nature of literary innovation? And it's a really good question, and I meant the end of my paper to be sort of open-ended. But I do think, I feel, I discovered a new genre in the lapdog poem. Had you heard about it before? And in the dog-narrated novel, and that they are operating in a kind of dissonant relationship to the conventional, normal genre of realist fiction or of certain modes of love poetry from the 17th and 18th century, that there's a problematic relationship between the genres generated by representations of animals and the traditional genres that I think is worth exploring. And I guess I'm feeling like if I was only a closer reader, I would be coming up with other new genres that used animals and in which the animal appearance of the animal militated against something that was more normative and more conventional in literary history. Yes.
I'm also a real cook of the new genre too, because it's to be the lapdog poem. I'm curious in listening to you talk about that, it seems like there's another dimension to that as well, and that the dogs, I think, sort of not only is a metaphor, as a vehicle for the expression of sexual desire on the part of the dogs, but also I think maybe some envy over what dogs can do within the gaze of other humans, the public sphere, that another human being could not express affection.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of wondering if the waning of the genre might in some way be correlated with a growing tolerance of what was permissible in the Mm-hmm. For example, you know, now we see two people walking down the street, and they're a couple of making out the
park. Or even licking. Or even licking. That would be fine, too.
But those would have been really scandalous.
Yeah. I think that's a really good observation and a good avenue to pursue. The question is whether the new genres, and in particular the lapdog poem, isn't providing a representation of certain activities that indicate intimacy that wouldn't have been permitted between people. And so the dog provides a means of depicting certain intimate behaviors that then might get translated and transmitted into representations for human intimacy. One of the avenues that I really want to explore, and I think it's possible to do so in Dickens' novels, is what I alluded to really briefly, which is the way in which animal innovations generated by the representations of animals get taken up by the literary tradition and move from the animal-human interaction to something that is connected with the with human interactions. And ideas of affinity connected and definitions of intimate relationships that can be based on difference rather than on identity is an interesting avenue for me in a way that one can leave the lapdog poetry behind as a kind of originating premise and move into works that don't themselves depict animals, but might be utilizing those innovations in new ways. Anne.
Mm-hmm. On, you know, maybe the sublimation of improper behavior, perceived improper behavior. So the relationship of the reader and maybe parental guidance funneling it toward animals is interesting.
Yes, taking animal, that question, Anne's question is about the relationship about utilizing animals as a way of representing forbidden behaviors or connections that then are able to be represented in that form. One of the interesting things about the rise of animals in literary works in the 19th century, not in the 18th century, is that the development of animal biography and autobiography is generated by literature for children. The first place where you find these stories about animal paradise and about representations of animal connects dreams about humans is in children's literature, but then it emerges and becomes a form that's widely read by all audiences. So the role of juvenile literature produced for a juvenile audience is really significant in understanding these kinds of innovations, how they're created, and how they're spread. So that's a crucial question about once you've started to focus on writing for children, then you have all kinds of other motivations, instructional ones and conduct ones. Yes, go ahead. Wolf? Feral children. Yeah. A little bit. This was a period where there was also a fascination with a kind of transposition of human and animals, so that children raised by animals or wild children or individuals who lacked human contact and were then brought into the human world and supposedly educated, produced all kinds of speculations about the relationship between human and animal. And yeah, that's definitely an interesting avenue. I don't know that it produced, but we need to look and see whether it produces a whole another subgenre of the the feral human that is, it's certainly in the scientific and philosophical discourse really an interesting issue. Yeah. There were lapdogs in the medieval period as pets of aristocratic women, but there were many fewer. The explosion in the middle class interest in lapdogs is what we're referring to when we talk about the rise of pet keeping. And coincident with the rise of pet keeping and this interest in a companionate relationship with animals is the development of all the numerous breeds that proliferated in the beginning in the 18th century and going into the 19th century that we now see today. These are all human, these are all products of the human obsession with the dog. And I don't even know how many dog breeds there currently are, but there were many, many fewer as we go back to the earlier periods. So we created dogs to fit our pre-image of the dog companion we most wanted. One more question. Yes.
Mm-hmm. The dog prevents the woman from being re-embodied, right? So I'm wondering if, in that case, as with Poke, the dog, the lap dog, forces Belinda awake, right, back into the sort of reality and seeing her Billadoo and away from this kind of dream of the supernatural. And that juxtaposition is so much what the mock epic is founded upon, it seems, that juxtaposition of the high and the low. So I'm wondering. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So that question is about whether the major writers reading these popular works about lapdogs don't then absorb them, but treat them in a different way and make them serve their own particular and somewhat different relationship to literary innovation. I think that's probably really true, and that's a dimension of the project that I was gesturing to at the end. That is, all right, it's all very well to notice that Pope's Rape of the Lock includes this allusion to the lapdog poem that, if you know about that context, makes you read the whole thing in a different way. But then, what is the next step? Why is Pope making that allusion? What is he doing with it? And the canonical writers are usually doing something more complicated with those conventions than the Delia poems that I had on the screen earlier on. So that's another avenue which I don't feel we've explored. So I'm sort of advocating animal studies as a way of understanding the development of literary forms from a different perspective and as a way of in particular trying to track the nature of literary innovation with some more precision and detail based on this, the prominence and relationship with the animal. So thank you very much for coming. It was a pleasure to be able to talk to you all about this.